It's 4:06 and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll be talking about falling water levels in the Great Lakes and get an update on funding issues for lake preservation.
First, though, we're going to be talking about something else that might hit close to home, especially in the summer.
We're known in Wisconsin for our summer beer gardens, outdoor live music. It's hard to imagine Wisconsin summer without the alcohol.
Well, turns out less than a century ago, that was exactly the reality.
Yeah, our producer Galen Druk actually ran across some archive material. That's what set us to thinking about this topic to do today. We're going to hear about Wisconsin summers back in the Prohibition era.
And here to talk about it is State Historic Preservation Officer Jim Drager. He's also the author of Bottoms Up, A Toast to Wisconsin's Historic Bars and Breweries. Jim, welcome.
Thanks.
Well, we have an article that was published in the Milwaukee Telegram on April 6, 1922. Tell us about the article and what that would have said about Prohibition.
Well, in 1922, we are 2 years into Prohibition, and people are still mourning the loss of the beer garden culture that was such a part of Milwaukee and other Germanic communities in Wisconsin. And that was probably the most direct impact on people of Prohibition, because As you know, people didn't stop drinking during Prohibition. Drinking moved underground, and it meant that public drinking places like beer gardens couldn't function anymore, and people moved to speakeasies.
So did they try to have something like the beer gardens with something other than the beer, or did those just go away?
Those just really went away. You know, the most famous beer garden in Milwaukee was the Schlitz Palm Garden, and it was the number one tourist attraction in Milwaukee in the days before Prohibition, and it just literally closed its doors, and the contents were sold off, and it disappeared, never to be seen again.
So what was summer like in Wisconsin without these iconic pastimes?
Well, they were still wet. You know, one of the probably the biggest truth about Prohibition in Wisconsin is people continued to drink. Prohibition was a really flawed concept. There were many loopholes in Prohibition that allowed people to easily get alcohol. For example, the manufacture, sale, and distribution of alcohol was banned by Prohibition, but it was still legal to have booze if that booze was purchased before Prohibition came into effect. So there was a great bootleg industry in booze bottles and fake tax stamps that people could fill with illegal booze and make it legal so that they could consume it. So Prohibition was essentially not unenforceable, but very, very difficult to enforce in Wisconsin.
It sounds like people were pretty crafty about the ways they got around it. But you do think of Wisconsin in the summertime, you think about drinking out of doors. So was that completely off the books then, or did people find ways to do that?
Well, people, you know, you couldn't drink at public places, but certainly people could drink in their own backyards. And there was a lot of drinking up in northern Wisconsin in the resort areas, especially because if you think about that era of time, you had all of the Chicago bootleggers that were running up to northern Wisconsin, both to buy booze from bootleggers who were bootlegging up there, but also to intercept shipments of booze that were coming from Canada and coming into the United States. So there was an easy free flow of liquor in northern Wisconsin. And if you went to one of those resorts, those resorts are private property, and you know somebody has to have a search warrant to come into to raid them. So it was wet in those places.
You know, just before the show, you shared a quote from your book. I think it was from one of the enforcement agents.
Yeah.
Do you have that handy?
Yeah.
Sure. In your book?
Sure. Frank Buckley was the chief federal prohibition officer in Wisconsin. So he's in charge of the federal efforts in enforcing prohibition. And, in 1928, Wisconsin withdrew their support of prohibition. So after 1928, all prohibition enforcement in Wisconsin was federal only. There were no state or local officials that were enforcing prohibition. So Frank Buckley is writing in his frustration, and he noted that the federal government stands alone, a pitiful barrier against an overwhelming torrent of booze.
So after Wisconsin said, all right, we're done with the war on booze. Yeah. I mean, you said people were already drinking plenty. Did that, were there any floodgates left to open when that decision was made?
No, you know, by the time that prohibition was lifted in Wisconsin in 1933, it largely had not been enforced because there just weren't people to make arrests or make busts. There were, you know, a handful of prohibition agents in an entire state trying to stem the flow, and the number of speakeasies was just enormous. Frank Buckley notes in this report that he wrote that in Milwaukee there were 1,217 ice cream parlors and soda fountains. All of them were speakeasies. Well, so you can do the simple math on that.
You mentioned before that folks would come up from Chicago to northern Wisconsin to the resorts to get their hit of alcohol.
Sure.
What was it about northern Wisconsin? Was it just so out of the way?
Yeah, it was out of the way, sure. And places were remote, and it gave them more cover in urban areas. It's a lot more, there are a lot more people, and there are a lot more chances for people to accidentally find out what you're doing and spread the word to other people and, you know, rat you out.
You know, it's funny because I think about northern Wisconsin today, and it seems like it still has a pretty strong tavern culture.
Yeah.
That's a big part of northern Wisconsin. Is that something that started maybe back then, has persisted, or is it just the nature of northern Wisconsin?
It's certainly not. It certainly didn't start during Prohibition. Really, it started with the logging and mining days of northern Wisconsin. You know, Hurley, around 1900, had an extreme number of taverns. They had taverns on every block of the downtown, and there were buildings that had basement, first story, and second story taverns, because all the miners and loggers would gather to Hurley every weekend and spend all of their money and then, you know, go back to the mines or the woods broken, hung over on Monday morning to start all over again.
Some people chalk up Wisconsin's drinking and beer heritage to German immigrants, especially the German brewers.
Yeah.
In the time of Prohibition, was there a divide between some ethnic groups who were very anti-Prohibition and others who were more temperance-oriented?
Yeah, there certainly were some cultural divides there. In Wisconsin, the strongest leaders of the temperance movement, which led to Prohibition, were largely Yankees. They were people who came from the New England states and settled in Wisconsin. They were the movers and shakers. They were the people with money and power in the early days of Wisconsin. And they pushed a strong temperance agenda. But by the 1840s, this huge wave of Germans comes flooding in, followed by the Irish and the Poles. And these are people who come from drinking cultures. And there was really a battle back and forth between those two groups into the all the way up to Prohibition.
Now, some counties in Wisconsin, as I understand it, remained dry even after Prohibition ended, though. Can you tell us about that? And also, I've gone through Door County, as a bunch of us have, and I've heard that Ephraim is dry.
Yeah, there certainly were places that were dry and continued to be dry. One of the hotbeds of that was Richland County, Richland Center, being the center of that. And Richland Center was a very big believer in abolition and in women's suffrage. There was a very, very strong women's movement in Richland Center before Prohibition, and women were the primary drivers of Prohibition. And so, not surprisingly, it had very strong roots in Richland Center. Richland Center didn't become wet until the 1970s or early 80s.
I've watched episodes of The Untouchables. There's like this running gun battle in Chicago during Prohibition. The movie Public Enemies showed John Dillinger and his gang here in Wisconsin. But was that the exception here in the state, or were there a lot of shootouts either among bootleggers or between bootleggers and those federal agents?
There wasn't that much gun violence. That's more kind of a movie account. But there were certainly busts where Prohibition agents would come in and raid a facility and break it up. I read a fascinating account of a bootlegger in Oshkosh who ran what was called a wildcat brewery, which meant that they would brew beer then break down and move to another location and brew there, and then break down, move back to the other location to try to stay under the radar of the prohibition agents. And he said every once in a while they would get busted. The agents would come in, break up all the machinery, but he realized pretty quickly that they weren't really out to destroy them. They would bust stuff up and they'd have to bring it to a metal shop and get it straightened out again. But they never really wrecked anything. And his belief was they didn't wreck it because then they could go and bust them again. And it made them look good and, you know, made them look like they were being effective in enforcing prohibition. And he also listed the payoffs he made to the chief of police and to the district attorney, how many cases of beer they were paid every week to keep him on the down low.
Jim, thanks a lot for joining us today. Hope we can have you back to talk Wisconsin history again.
That would be wonderful. I'd love to do that.
That's Jim Drager. He's State Historic Preservation Officer, author of Bottoms Up, A Toast to Wisconsin's Historic Bars and Breweries.
And now we'll check headlines and then look at some new challenges for the Great Lakes. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Verrett. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We talked earlier in the week about plastic particles showing up in the Great Lakes, but that's really not the only problem going on.
Low water levels in the lakes are also ringing alarm bells. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel has a series on the topic this week.
Lots of people are calling for more dredging of the lakes, but the money to do that seems to be disappearing along with the water.
A congressional subcommittee voted last week to cut funds for the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative by about 80%. Some of that funding has been restored as of this morning, though.
Joining us to talk about all of this is Todd Ames, campaign director for Healing Our Waters, Great Lakes Coalition. Todd, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. Glad to be on.
I want to start with those low water levels. What's going on with the water levels in the Great Lakes?
Well, there's several theories out there, but certainly there's a couple of key culprits. First of all, back up a bit. As I suspect a number of your listeners know, but the nature of the Great Lakes is it really operates as kind of a gigantic river system, if you will, that was created by the glaciers about 10,000 years ago, in that they all drain, starting in Lake Superior, all the way down through Michigan and Huron and into Erie and into Ontario and ultimately out the St. Lawrence Seaway into the Atlantic Ocean. So how that drainage happens and how much precipitation and evaporation you have has caused the lakes over those 10,000 years to fluctuate up and down actually several feet. But in the last more than a decade now, we've actually seen some record low water levels, despite the fact that we've had above-average precipitation patterns during that time period. Certainly one of the leading culprits, all of the modeling and research and science suggests, is the impacts of climate change, and specifically the fact that we have less ice on the lakes in the wintertime. Ice reflects sunlight and keeps water from evaporating up into the atmosphere, and so the less ice that you have, the more evaporation you have. And so that has been certainly a very big culprit. And then there's also some concerns about some historical dredging that took place on the St. Clair River over by Detroit has caused some additional outflow of water out of the Great Lakes into the St. Lawrence Seaway. So those are a couple of kind of the main theories and thoughts behind what's causing the lower water levels today.
Now, we're looking at Lake Michigan. I understand Lake Michigan is down about 3 feet and has been for quite a while. But this isn't just a matter of water levels. This affects people's properties and their ways of life, sometimes their livelihood. Can you talk a little bit about how people are affected by different water levels, lower water levels?
Well, certainly, challenge when you are right on a lake the size of any of our Great Lakes, of course, you want to have that your property, your dwelling, and certainly your dock right there at the right water level makes it a great challenge when the water levels fluctuate. And when they are consistently low, What has happened with a lot of people's property is they find that their dock is quite a ways removed from where the current water level is. So very real impact to people's access to the lake and, in turn, property values has occurred. Certainly the other issue when you've got the lower water levels, if you're able to get to the lake, okay, you may still have trouble in terms of draft on your boat. You may be hitting bottom in places that you never thought you would hit bottom because of lower water levels. So there's just a variety of challenges you can have with those lower water levels.
Now, Lake Superior is sort of, I would imagine, especially sensitive. It's a really historically pretty cold lake, and it's changing dramatically. In the winter, they have that ice road between Madeline Island and the mainland, and the water temperatures, I gather, are changing. Give us the pulse of Lake Superior right now.
Well, again, the science suggests that over the last 40 years or so that the amount of ice cover on Lake Superior has dropped by about 75%. So that's a rather dramatic change.
Yeah, it's a big number.
Yeah, yeah, and we still have anomaly years. 2009 actually had quite a bit of ice cover over most of the lake, but you know, this past winter we probably had no more than about 10% of the lake with ice cover on it. So. And, of course, what that does then is you get more the water, because it's water rather than ice, the water warms up quicker in the springtime, quicker into the summer. And the warmer it is heading into the fall, when you've got that warm water that hits the cool fall air, that then causes this greater evaporation activity to happen, and the water literally gets sucked up into the sky when you have that phenomenon. So it's a very real challenging issue. And what's going to happen in the future is there's lots of theories, but we're simply going to have to wait and see. But we certainly have not seen anything quite like this in the last 150 years or so of a fairly detailed record keeping on the water levels of the Great Lakes.
Now, is the primary culprit here that we're looking at, is it climate change?
Well, certainly the evapotranspiration that we're having, the less ice and the warming of water temperatures, is all of the models associated with climate change predicted that this would happen, and in fact, this seems to be the case. The other thing that's happening, which is interesting and vexing phenomenon, is that the models predicted related to climate change was that in the upper Midwest we would have a lot more large precipitation events, that is, very large rainstorms or snowstorms. And on the one hand, that can cause for a great deal of replenishment, as happened with a lot of rain that we had in April and May of this year that caused water levels to come up pretty fast in both Lake Michigan and Lake Huron. But, of course, the problem on the water quality side of the equation is that when you have those big rain events, you have lots of stuff that can wash into the tributaries and also into the lakes and cause algae blooms and other sorts of contamination in the lakes. So you kind of we're kind of getting it at both ends of the spectrum in terms of impacts to the lakes thanks to climate change.
And I've only got about a minute left before we go to break, but there's the funding issue here. A congressional subcommittee voted last week to cut funds for Great Lakes restoration by about 80%, but then that was restored. I think the number is now something like $210 million. Can you give us an update on the funding?
Yeah, on the House side, they did restore part of it to $210 million. That was certainly a step in the right direction, but we want to see it restored up to its appropriation level of $300 million in the last fiscal year. We have a lot of bipartisan support and champions in the Great Lakes delegation that we think will step forward and help us. In fact, that's already occurred on the Senate side. The Senate released their draft bill today, and they started at $300 million. So we're very confident that we're going to be able to get those funds secured on both sides of the House so we can continue to do the great work that this restoration fund has done over the last 4 years, and
okay.
I can talk a little bit more about that.
We will in just a moment. And we're talking with Todd Ames about some challenges facing the Great Lakes, and we want to hear from you, your experiences on the lakes. Have you seen the water level drop? What is your experience as you're out there on the lake?
Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking with Todd Ames about some of the challenges facing the Great Lakes. And we'd love to hear your stories, too. Do you vacation on one of these lakes, Michigan or Superior? And have you noticed changes over the years? Beaches, where there didn't used to be beaches. Warmer water. Disappearance of ice in the winter. What is your personal experience as these lakes around us change? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And as we went into the break there, Todd, you were talking about being optimistic about funding from Congress ultimately to help preserve the Great Lakes. With that money, what would be done to help?
Well, that is one of the real, in the midst of all the challenges, and we touched about on a couple of them relative to water levels, there's a lot of really exciting, positive things that are happening for the Great Lakes, and it's in large part due to the fact that we have a very broad bipartisan support for taking action on the Great Lakes. One of the ways that that has manifested itself has been support for a relatively new initiative called the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, which was the funding I was talking about before the break. That has been around since 2010. There's been a little over $1 billion that has come to the Great Lakes in that time period. And it really, in an era where we look to Washington and point to it as the place where things don't work, I would suggest that this is one of those really shining stars of things that are working. Thanks to that funding already, we have been addressing toxic hotspots all over the basin from Pennsylvania to Wisconsin, improving public health, goes to protecting drinking water supplies for the roughly 30 million people in the nation's heartland. So we've seen a number of toxic spots cleaned up. We've seen a lot of wetlands restored. We've seen rivers in habitat improved that are tributaries to the Great Lakes. It's really a bright spot, and everybody, I think, associated with it will point to it and talk about the great work that's been done. The only thing that we really has been a challenge over those years has been maintaining the funding to do the work. And as long as we've got the funding, we've got lots of good a good plan in place, a lot of folks headed in the right direction, and there's much more really positive things that can be done for the lakes if we can keep that funding going.
Let's go to the phones right now. We have Tom with us in Cedarburg. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I read a few times that there's down in Chicago that the major river that runs through town used to flow into Lake Michigan, but it was re-engineered about 100 years ago or so, and now it flows out of Lake Michigan through Chicago down to Mississippi, and that's one of the larger leaks also in this lake. I was wondering if your guest knows about that and how much effect that has on the dropping water levels.
Okay, thanks, Tom. And what do you think, Todd?
Yeah, well, he is correct that about 100 years ago, the flow of the Chicago River and the ship canal was actually reversed. Was actually done at that time because of concerns about cholera and typhoid outbreaks in Chicago. And with the upcoming World's Fair coming up there, they didn't want that to happen, so they just reversed the flow of the river. That has certainly caused, as the caller notes, some outflow, although not a huge amount in the overall scheme of things for the Great Lakes as a whole, and certainly since it's been going on for about 100 years, it is certainly not pointed to as one of the primary culprits for problematic water levels. Interestingly, there's the amount of water that flows out there is actually dwarfed by two larger projects that happened in the middle of the 20th century up in Canada that actually reversed two rivers up there to flow into Lake Superior. In that case, they actually added water to the Great Lakes. That was actually for hydropower operations to manufacture weapons for the World War II war effort, and that has remained. So there's been some interesting hydrologic engineering issues that have happened around the lakes, but again, on balance, those are not the bigger challenges related to overall water levels. It has been this evaporation due to the warming water and also some concern relative to some dredging over on the eastern side of the Great Lakes Basin.
Now, speaking of dredging, it sounds like there are some folks out there who would like the Army Corps of Engineers to step in and do some more dredging of the lakes. So why aren't they stepping in right now?
Well, there's in a couple of places, there's been some issues with, in terms of dredging of harbors and bays, there's some challenges in terms of adequate funding for doing that dredging in those places. And there's been a big, as has been the case for the last, certainly no secret to anybody, we've had some budget challenges at the federal level. And for the last few years, that's been one source of conflict and challenge is getting adequate funding for that, those sorts of dredging projects. Other sorts of dredging that have that are talked about a lot relate to specifically the St. Clair River over near Detroit, and the question of whether or not dredging and scouring of that riverbed has actually exacerbated the amount of water that flows through there and then ultimately out into the Atlantic Ocean, and some concerns about how to arrest that problem.
All right. Well, thank you so much. And we'll go to Joe in Milwaukee.
Hi. I just want to, or first thing is about the, seems like you're kind of not putting that much emphasis on Chicago's drainage as well, and they're draining billions of gallons of water out every single day, and that's a significant amount of water. You know, so that's something that shouldn't be overlooked. And the other thing is, all this money keeps getting thrown at for the entire Great Lakes region in regard to the environment and making things better. Yet down in the Chicagoland area, and they're not the only culprits, they're dumping billions of gallons of chemicals and waste and whatnot every single year. That's my comment.
Okay, thanks a lot, Joe. Todd?
Yeah, well, certainly the caller makes a couple of good points. Again, as it relates to the what's called the Chicago diversion, it's right now it's a little over 2 billion gallons of water a day that comes out of there. They can go up to as high as 3 billion gallons a day. But again, the amount of water coming into Lake Superior, for instance, thanks to those diversions, is about 4.5 billion gallons a day. So it does balance itself out on that front. In terms of the toxic contamination or sewage overflows or any of those challenges, certainly we continue to be concerned about those issues, the whole issue of how to upgrade our wastewater infrastructure across the Great Lakes Basin. Is a big concern, certainly enforcing the Clean Water Act, where we're having overflows during rain events, et cetera, is important, and we certainly believe that that should be a priority. So those are all important and, as the caller notes, serious challenges to the Great Lakes, and actually part of this restoration money goes to address a number of those water quality challenges.
And one last question for you, Todd. So we're talking about using some money from Congress to get a handle on some issues like pollution, and there are things we can do to divert water, control the amount going in and out of the Great Lakes. But it seems as though the juggernaut is really climate change in terms of the amount of water. We're talking about 1/5 of the world's fresh water in the Great Lakes. What is your outlook in terms of climate change and drinkable water?
Yeah, well, it is a very people have a every reason to be concerned about this. We just don't know how this is all going to work out in the end. What we do know is that the climate models have certainly begun to come to pass, that we're seeing these larger, big precipitation events that is bringing more water in and short, intense doses to the Great Lakes Basin. At the same time, because of less ice cover, you've got water leaving through evaporation. You read the science literature, you look into the future, you crystal ball it. Some folks are very, very concerned that we're going to have continued low water levels. Others see a rebound in the coming years. Obviously, we've not seen anything quite like the impacts of the current climate change, and we can only do the best that we can to adapt to those changes and do our best to protect the most significant freshwater resource on the planet, which is our Great Lakes.
All right. Well, Todd, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
I'm talking with Todd Ames, Campaign Director for Healing Our Waters, Great Lakes Coalition.
Coming up next, we'll look at the foods that are making their way to our plates that may not be what they seem and how we can avoid them. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. Well, earlier this year, there was a food scandal story, testing seafood in New York City found 39% of seafood was actually a different species than it was labeled.
And the incidences of food fraud are actually growing. Our guest today reported on the 11 most fraudulent foods for prevention.com.
Joining us now is Mandy Oaklander, Senior Associate Editor of Prevention. Thanks for joining us, Mandy.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob.
So you looked into foods that are faked in one way or another. How common is this?
Exactly. It's a lot more common than I thought. I was pretty shocked when I first learned about food fraud, where foods are secretly cut with other ingredients and not labeled. In fact, there's an entire database, which is foodfraud.org, that lists these incidents. The thing to remember, though, is that most of these ingredients aren't dangerous, so there's really no need to panic, but they are pretty insidious.
Usually they're not dangerous. I read a couple incidences in this article where there was something like a possible carcinogen that's been added to the food.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's pretty shocking, actually. I came across some instances of detergents and urea, all kinds of weird ingredients that you really don't want to find in your food. If you get food poisoning, that's pretty much how you know that your food has been laced with something.
All right. Well, now that we've talked about urea and carcinogens, tell us what foods they're in so we can avoid them.
Absolutely. Well, the first number one most adulterated food is olive oil. Usually it's not cut with anything dangerous unless you have a nut allergy. It's most often cut with hazelnut oil and also corn oil, sunflower oil. All of these various oils that blend in with olive oil, you can't tell a difference visually. But in milk, actually, it's often cut with milk from other animals that you're really not expecting. Like sheep's milk is sometimes cut with bovine milk. Buffalo milk can be cut with goat antelope milk, which I wasn't even aware there's a goat antelope. But it can also be adulterated by powdered milk in urea, which is used in fertilizer, detergent, sugar, salt, all of these have been recorded.
And the big issue probably as consumers, as you said, for the most part, isn't a health thing. But if you're in a store, you're buying some olive oil. In the theory, you're buying olive oil, right?
Right. Yeah, that's what you'd hope. but you have to be really careful when, especially when buying these top 11 most adulterated foods. Something you can do to protect yourself is to buy from someone you trust, from a company that has a vested interest in keeping you as a repeat customer. That's sort of why I love farmers markets and little local grocery stores. You can ask where your food is coming from.
But if you're in the grocery store, you're in the aisle for olive oil or some of the other products we'll talk about, on the spot, you want to go home and cook with this stuff now. I mean, is there any way we're in the store we can make a good decision and get what we think we're getting?
That's the question the folks at foodfraud.org are trying to figure out, exactly what the patterns are in these adulterated foods and why these foods are being targeted. A lot of the foods on the list are premium products, like olive oil, and they're trying to figure out exactly how you can protect yourself. But a good way, aside from shopping at a farmer's market, which isn't always feasible, is to choose the least processed food you can find. So try to stay away from packaged foods. And unfortunately, that's about the best we have to offer right now.
So, Mandy, aren't they breaking the law, though? If I'm at the store and I'm buying something that I think is olive oil and it doesn't list, you know, all these other random things that are in it, or a carton of milk that happens to have sheep's milk and powdered milk in it, why isn't that illegal?
Right. Well, it is illegal. And that's why, actually, until now, this hasn't really been considered a serious thing by the food community, by the scientific community. It's just now starting to be studied and cataloged, which is incredible. And I'm so glad that the folks at foodfraud.org are doing this. It's open access. Anyone can see. And it dates back to 1980, so there are some pretty dated reports in there. But it's interesting to see that it keeps happening. And recently they added reports from 2011 and 2012, and there were 800 new records. So it's definitely not stopping, but hopefully by calling people's attention to it, people will start to demand that their food be what they pay for.
Well, I want to get to some of the other items on the list of fraudulent foods. Coffee. Say it isn't so. There's adulterated coffee. They're not putting decaf in it, are they?
No, unfortunately. This one was a wake-up call for me. I found out there were twigs, roasted corn, roasted barley, and even ground parchment in some of the coffee that's been cataloged.
Parchment is in parchment paper?
Yeah, ground paper, essentially.
So that's not when you get the beans, though, right? They can't get that stuff when you got your coffee beans. We're talking about the pre-ground stuff.
That's a good question. I'm pretty sure that they were studying ground coffee. They also studied instant coffee, and that was cut with some different things, cut with chicory, cereal, caramel, more parchment, and figs.
Caramel sounds okay, but I don't know about the other stuff.
Yeah, wake up with a great taste of parchment.
Oh, we shouldn't laugh.
No, yeah, well. And then apple juice was also on your list.
Yeah, apple juice sounds really innocent, but sometimes it's laced with a lot of sugary stuff, grape juice, high fructose corn syrup, pear juice, pineapple juice, raisin sweetener. I mean, it's bad if you have an allergy to any of those. Can't really tell what you're getting.
And what is that, if it's labeled 100% juice, I guess it could be labeled with the other fruits, but I'm hoping if it says 100% juice, it's not got the high fructose corn syrup in it.
Yeah, you would really hope. You just have to buy from companies that you trust and really do your homework and stick with the companies that you know are delivering a credible product.
Hey, our producer, our gluten-free producer, Galen Druk, lets us know if he finds that barley in his coffee, that is a serious health concern potentially.
Yeah, it really could be, unfortunately.
Which makes you wonder why there isn't some sort of legislation, you know, requiring people to list it on there. But maybe we're in the beginning stages and we'll have to just raise awareness like we're doing now. Well, another area, and this has been talked about some, but it bears talking about some more, is seafood, is fish. Now, it seems like a lot of seafood there is getting mislabeled.
Yeah, fish fraud is one of the biggest problems. You mentioned that the stat about New York City, but the conservation group Oceana found that 74% of fish at sushi restaurants is mislabeled as a different species.
That's a huge number, 74% of the fish you're eating. How can that happen?
I think a lot of us don't really know what fish is supposed to look like, so it's probably pretty easy, although it's absolutely wrong. They also found that 59% of tuna is mislabeled as a different species.
Wow. So who's the villain? I don't know if anyone's a villain, but I mean, is it do the fishermen not know what they're catching? Do the sushi chefs not know that they're not preparing the right fish? Where does it break down?
Yeah, that's a great question. I would love to do a follow-up article to answer it. It's hard to pinpoint exactly where this is going wrong.
Well, looking at the list and compiling this, Mandy, do you think twice now at the grocery store?
Oh, my gosh, yes, absolutely. I really try not to buy too many packaged foods. And luckily, through this job, I've come into contact with so many great companies that I really do believe are putting out a quality product. So I'll spend more money at the grocery store to get something I know is, you know, accurate.
And just to run through a few more on the list, now we've covered coffee and apple juice and olive oil and fish. What else should we be aware of?
Honey is something that's gotten a lot of press recently. Smuggled honey coming in from China is often laced with banned antibiotics. That's a really hard one to avoid. But if you buy local honey that you know is being produced pretty close to where you are, that's a good way to avoid it. In addition to those scary antibiotics, sometimes honey is laced with added sugar, like more corn syrup, fructose, beet sugar, anything sweet that can't be detected.
Well, that's been a big one here in Wisconsin, and I think there's been some legislation on that. We're a big honey-producing state, so I think a lot of the honey producers are saying, hey, this cheap stuff coming from outside our borders here isn't really honey at all.
Exactly, yeah.
Well, Mandy, thank you so much for joining us today. We'll keep our eyes out. And in the meantime, I guess you'd say keep an eye on that website, foodfraud.org.
That's right. Thanks so much for having me.
All right. Thank you. That was Mandy Oaklander, Senior Associate Editor of Prevention.com.
Coming up, we're going to have some fun. We're going to talk about garage rock here in Wisconsin, especially in Milwaukee, with the author of a new book on the subject. And we'll hear from you. Were you in a garage band? Are you? Do you rock the basement every now and again? We'll hope to hear from you coming up. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Stay tuned. You're listening to Central Time right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. There's more to come.